People often catch cold from one another when shut up together in small, close rooms, coaches, etc., and when sitting near and conversing so as to breathe in each other's transpiration. So commented Benjamin Franklin in the 18th century. Sir William Osler noted, "The only way to treat a common cold is with contempt." Americans today spend billions on cold remedies, yet miss more days of work due to colds than to any other illness. Why is it that we've made enormous gains in organ transplantation and genetic sequencing, but still are failing in the battle against the common cold? I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Sneezing, coughing, and sniffling. We've all been victims of the common cold. Why do we get colds more often at some times of the year than others? What's the relationship between colds, allergies, and asthma? Why do some people seem to get more colds than others? And what's fact and what's myth about so-called cures for the common cold? Joining us to explore the battle against the common cold is James Gern, professor of pediatrics and medicine at the UW-Madison.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Great. Thank you very much.
Keep your distance, will you? That's something we have to be careful with.
I think I was cleared on the way in. So.
Well, as long as Emily mentioned Benjamin Franklin, there's a great story, and I think it's believed to be true, about Benjamin Franklin and John Adams. And during the time of the Revolution, they had to share a bed. It was common practice in those days. And they had an argument over to have the window opened or closed. And Franklin said, it's going to be healthier if we have the window open. John Adams said, no, you'll get those harmful vapors coming in. I want the window closed. And so they compromised. And as soon as Adams fell asleep, Franklin opened the window. So who had it right in that situation?
I think Emily pointed out there's been a lack of progress in some areas. And I think whether or not to keep the window open is one of those unexplored areas. So.
But if we talk about the common cold, am I going very far out on a limb at all to say there is really no such thing as a common cold, that it must be a really diverse complex of all kinds of things lumped that way?
Yeah, that's been one of the challenges when you think about different illnesses and what causes them. There are probably 200-plus viruses that can cause the common cold. So it's quite a diverse array of viruses that actually have some quite different lifestyles and replication cycles and so forth. So it's been challenging to have one remedy that's really going to treat all of those different viruses.
What does it have to be called a cold? You know, because you have people who say, oh, I've got the flu, I've got the cold, I've got a virus. We sort of toss various terms around. So what is a cold?
Mainly when people think about colds, you're talking about upper airway symptoms. So you have a stuffy nose and sneezing and runny nose. I think those are the hallmarks of the cold. Most colds actually start with a little bit of a sore throat as well. And what differentiates a cold from the flu is generally the time of year. So as you know, we're in the middle of flu season right now, although the season hasn't been too bad so far. But people with the flu start off with a cold, and then with the full-blown flu syndrome, we'll get fevers and headaches. So if you start off with a cold and then morph into those symptoms at this time of year, it's probably the flu.
So what makes a person susceptible to getting a cold?
That's a very good question, and we know some things that put you at increased risk. So the very young and the very old both are more likely to get colds. And then there are other individuals who are more likely to become more ill when they get colds. So if you have a chronic respiratory condition, most commonly would be asthma or chronic obstructive lung disease, and you get a cold, not only do you get the cold symptoms, but it can cause a flare of your underlying disorder. So you can get a child with asthma who, instead of just having a stuffy nose, will have coughing, wheezing. And, you know, frankly, it can send you to the hospital. It's the most common cause for, you know, those bad asthma attacks.
So if a person goes out, I mean, it's a cliche, but if a person goes out, you know, on a cold day without dressing warmly enough or without wearing a hat, and somebody says, well, you'll catch your death of cold. I mean, is there some legitimacy to that?
Perhaps, although there have been some studies. I think the one that is quoted most often is by the Department of Defense, who are interested in whether climatic conditions really influence who gets colds and who didn't. And so they actually chilled people and tried to show whether or not they were more or less likely to get colds. And there was no effect of chilling people. So that's still debated. It certainly sounds plausible that we know when the air starts to get chilly, that's when a cold season starts. But it's certainly not the only reason. And it seems to be more complicated than that.
So the perhaps maybe what's happening if, say, you get dumped in cold water or even very cold air, you're somehow weakened and more receptive to cold?
It's possible. It does seem that when you look at a number of factors that are stressors, the more stress you're under, the greater your susceptibility to a cold, the more likely you are to catch a cold. And that's been shown in studies looking at students around exam time. It's been shown in military recruits who, when they are put into basic training camps, become more susceptible. Of course, they have very close contact with other people as well. So it does seem like stress in general. And perhaps, if you really got overly chilled, that's just another form of stress.
I would think another factor would be exposure to small children, or at least it seems as if daycares
that creates stress.
Are breeding grounds for, and whether that's because there's all these toys being shared and secretions and so on, but it seems as if small children have a lot to do with
it. You really hit it on the head. It looks like for influenza as well as for common colds, we love our children, but we know that they are disease vectors. So the young kids are the ones that spread the illness. And there's actually a really well-performed study done in Finland recently that showed that. And they picked a number of families that had young children in the families, and they tracked using very sophisticated viral diagnostic techniques who got colds and who spread them. And it turned out that if an adult brings a cold into the home, it's actually very unlikely that it's going to spread for a couple of reasons. Number one, they probably shed less virus because, our immune systems are a little bit more in tune there. But the other thing is that adults will,
wash their hands
generally. Wash their hands, or at least not, blatantly spread the cold through unhygienic behavior. You try and be a little bit discreet. Kids, especially the 2 and 3 year olds, when they come home, with a cold, everyone's going to get it because the kids interact with everybody. They need a lot of care and they don't care at all who they sneeze on and so forth. So the young kids and up through probably early school age are the ones who spread the colds most readily, and the adults are the recipients. So, if you're a young mother, if you're a school teacher, if you're a pediatrician, until your immunity really builds up, and remember there's about 200 viruses you have to go through, you're really at risk in the fall and spring seasons.
And if you have a runny nose, let's say you have a child with a runny nose, how would you know if it's a cold as opposed to an allergy?
Yeah, that's a good question. Colds tend to start with a sore throat. And then you develop the nasal symptoms afterwards, and the colds can be associated with some mild fever. Allergies, on the other hand, tend not to start out with a sore throat. There's more itching and sneezing involved, and they tend to last longer. So a cold, most of the time it's come and gone, or at least going away by 7 days, whereas allergies, most of the tree pollen seasons and so forth, can be 3 weeks or longer. So symptoms that persist, especially if they hit you with the same season every year, tend to be allergies.
So give us some idea of the spectrum. You said there were 200 kinds of colds?
Yes.
And from mildest to most severe. I mean, we think of a cold as lasting, several days up to a week, and not really being incapacitating except for us broadcasters, of course.
Yep.
But really in itself, nothing serious. Is that true?
Yeah, I think we're starting to learn more about what these infections really do, because now we can tell when people have colds. It's very difficult to know for sure, if you have a virus or not. But recent developments and advances in diagnostic techniques make it possible now, at least in research studies. We have some where people have sent samples of their nasal secretions in on a weekly basis. We recently completed a study where we had 400 kids that did this, and we started the week before school. And then we sampled once a week through that first month of school. And, we knew that colds were very common, but actually 90% of kids who go back to school get a cold virus in that first month.
Oh, boy.
90%. But not everyone gets sick. So about 20 to 25% of kids have no symptoms at all. They have a virus that's replicating, but somehow it doesn't make them ill. Maybe 10% really are incapacitated with this. So you know, have the full-blown head cold, maybe a chest cough, a little bit of bronchitis along with it. Most people are kind of in between. So about half of the colds are fairly mild. And then, you know, we see about 20% or so that are moderate. They slow you down, but they don't stop you from what you're doing. So there's really a full range of illness. And again, we talked about the high-risk groups. There are some people who are more prone to those more severe colds.
So is the reaction that we get, the runny nose and so on, that's really almost like an autoimmune thing, and or it's our immune system responding to the virus? I mean, are people with weakened immune systems then almost better off in terms of not getting colds?
Well, if you have a weak immune system, you're actually a little bit more prone to developing colds and can get colds that last for longer periods of time. And we see that, again, the very young, the very old, and people who have, you know, other major illnesses going on. But it is true that your body's attempt to kill the virus really leads to some of the symptoms. So that's probably where some of the congestion and the runny nose and whatnot. So far, those sorts of insights have not led to major advances in treatment. We don't know exactly what it is about the immune system that provokes these symptoms.
Because if you take a decongestant, for example, aren't you just sort of killing the symptom and not the cause?
Yeah, that's right. You know, decongestants, other things that can give you symptom relief, like Tylenol, decongestants, there are some sprays now that can dry up the secretions in your nose. They really don't do anything for the course of the cold, but they can help keep you a little more comfortable.
Well, let me ask you a sort of very specific question. Let's say I have a cold right now. Mm-hmm. I've only had it for a day or two. And you're sitting there just, you know, a few feet from me. And I sneeze, I shake your hand, I, you know, breathe on you, whatever. What is the most likely way that you're going to come down with this cold? Mm-hmm. And then what would be the progress that would take place in your body as whatever I've just sneezed on you hits you?
Yeah. There have been some really clever experiments that have been performed to show how colds are spread. And a lot of that research was done right here at University of Wisconsin in the 1950s and 60s by Dr. Elliot Dick, who passed away a few years ago. He showed that colds can be spread both by droplets, which is how we think about the flu and some other common viruses, but also by hand contact. And so probably if you get, you know, a significant sneeze on yourself, you're at risk of inhaling that virus. It gets stuck in your nose or maybe even in your eyes. And that's where that replication cycle starts. And within about 24 hours of the time that you are inoculated with the virus, you'll start to have some mild symptoms. You know, I don't feel quite right, maybe a little bit of a sore throat. And then following those initial symptoms, you get the full-blown cold. Early on, you tend to get a clear, runny nose, kind of watery. And then later on, your body starts to make mucus, which has some properties that are actually helpful in fighting the cold. But, you know, it also causes quite a bit of
awkwardness
and uncomfortability. So I think that that's the general course of the cold. And then, you know, it resolves over several days. By and large, colds come and go in a week. Sometimes you'll get secondary infections afterwards. So most commonly in children would be an ear infection. Almost all ear infections start with a cold first. And in adults, you know, sinus infection or a bronchitis or something like that.
Well, in the scheme of things, in terms of catching a cold, what are the worst culprits? Is really shaking hands with someone the worst thing you can do to touch something that would give you a cold?
Yeah, there were two schools of thought, one in Madison. And in Madison, really, Dr. Dick here thought that droplet spray was the most common reason that colds were spread. And a researcher, Dr. Jack Waltney, who's at University of Virginia and is still doing some research, felt very strongly the other way. So these at common cold conferences, these two guys would get up and battle it out.
Uncommon.
But the bottom line is that, you know, practically speaking, you want to avoid both of those exposures.
What about close contact? You know, we opened with the Benjamin Franklin thing where he said you could get it in small rooms and in coaches. But these days when many of us fly, you know, you have this feeling on the airplane, you just have a lot of germs very close by you.
Yeah, there's concerns about air quality in aircraft, and maybe it's doing something to increase your susceptibility even apart from spreading the viruses in that small volume. It has been shown that two adults, you know, in the same room are unlikely to spread the cold unless they are husband and wife and they're sharing a bed and so forth, where, you know, you really have some prolonged contact in fairly close space for a long period of time. So that's the best way to spread it. I was mentioning the studies that Dr. Dick did. He went as far as to put, you know, the collars that dogs have, yes, when they have a wound on their paw or something.
Like funnels.
And yeah. He had poker players play poker with dog collars on. So it was impossible for these people to rub their eyes or rub their nose and spread by contact. And what he showed was, even with the dog collar on, if you had prolonged contact in a room, and humidity makes a bit of a difference, it can't be too wet or too dry, you can see spread along those lines.
Well, airplanes are sort of notorious for having dry air.
Yeah. The other place that common cold transmission was studied, again, by Dr. Dick, was he went to Antarctica. They have huts in Antarctica that are research stations that are very closed, and so he could track who brought colds in and who spread them.
And nothing ambient there. I mean, there's nothing in Antarctica other than what people bring in.
That's exactly right. And you talk about cool, dry conditions, that was it. And again, the same sort of results. It took prolonged contact when you had adults, but with kids, again, the spread is much more certain.
How important is it actually to cure a cold if you have it? I mean, if these symptoms, the increased mucus presence, for example, if those symptoms are all byproducts of your body fighting the cold, why not just let it run its course except for convenience sake?
Right. I think for many people, that's kind of their attitude. Colds are relatively minor illnesses for most people, and so you can let them run their course. And if it doesn't slow you down, that's great. For others, or if you get a really bad cold, you want something that's going to be able to help you do the things that you have to do each day, and you don't want to miss work or miss school, et cetera, et cetera. And so symptomatic relief is really important. And then you kind of go to the far end of the spectrum, kids with asthma, adults with asthma, who really are at risk for developing severe illnesses that can lead to hospitalization. And their, common cold prevention is much more important. And I think with the better diagnostic tests, what we're finding is that the very young children, so the kids that are 1 and 2 years of age who catch common cold viruses, actually can be hospitalized because of it. There's a lot of work going on right now to find out if some of these 200, cold viruses are nastier than others. And actually, our group, together with some other folks around the world, have recently found a new group of common cold viruses, about 60 new viruses. And these may be a little bit nastier than the ones that were found initially.
This is assuming that they don't change over the course of time into something else.
That's right.
I'm still a little confused about the difference between a cold virus and a flu virus. I mean, I understand that the symptoms are more severe with a flu. You get the fever and all that. But in terms of how the virus functions, how it looks, what it is, what's the difference? And what does a cold virus actually do when it enters your body? It just somehow gets into the cell and starts disrupting things?
Right. First of all, what's different about flu rather than colds? I'm not surprised you're confused, because they're really overlapping. Many kids and adults who get the flu just get a cold when they have influenza. So influenza is a particular type of virus. And of course, there's a different form of influenza that circulates each year. Last year was the H1N1 virus that was particularly nasty. But this virus, some years, is fairly mild and can cause cold symptoms, and other years it seems to be more severe. But the one thing that this virus will do that common cold viruses won't is to cause that high fever, headache, pneumonia in hospitalized individuals. So influenza is really one of the respiratory viruses. Virtually any of the other respiratory viruses mainly cause common colds. There's a few special ones that cause more severe disease in young children, but again, that overlaps with common cold viruses.
Is there a time of year that is worse for colds? I mean, we think of the winter because people are more in closed environments. Is that true?
Yeah, the common cold season really peaks in the fall, and it seems to be driven by kids going back to school, again, spreading all of the viruses and then bringing them home. So you can actually track that, where the six-year-old kids will get the viruses first, and then they come home and spread them to the infants and their parents. So the peaks for those are actually different by a few days. And Emily, you asked about how do common cold viruses work. I mean, how do they cause disease? And by their nature, they will stick to the lining of our respiratory tract. So epithelial cells are what lines, the throat, the nose, and the tubes that go down into the chest. And once they stick to these epithelial cells, they go in and they pretty much take over the cell metabolism and turn each of those little cells into factories that make more common cold viruses. So really, what a cold is, it's kind of a race between the virus trying to make as many copies of itself as it can, because the more viruses you make, the more likely you are to spread that cold to the next person. And then your body's immune system, to try and recognize that virus and keep that from occurring, both to limit, you know, the severity of your own illness and also probably to so that it doesn't spread to other people.
So in effect, the common cold really is competition.
It's a competition. There's no doubt about it. And when that virus is recognized, your body will send in white blood cells. And, you know, there's a number of changes to your physiology in the airway. Your nose gets stuffy. There's more blood flow, you know, that's going into the nose. You start to make all these secretions, probably to help wash the virus out of the nose. And this kind of adds up to the common cold symptoms that we're all familiar with.
And so would each cold then lead to a different antibody?
Yeah, your body will make an antibody response. And so if you have a really good antibody response, you'll never have that cold again. But again, with all of those viruses out there,
99 more to go.
That's right. And the flu, of course, changes every year. So there's very little memory to the flu.
We're going to look at some possible cures to the common cold when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. A family is a unit composed not only of men, women, and an occasional animal, but of the common cold. That's a quote by Ogden Nash. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is James Gern, and we are talking about battling the common cold. I'm curious about what kinds of myths and misconceptions you run into when you hear people talk about the cold, because I've heard everything from you should have chicken soup to maybe echinacea, different supplements. You know, you hear a lot of people that are trotting out various remedies. What sort of, I guess, facts and myths do you see around you?
Personally, I'd love to hear common cold remedies, because it shows, you know, the creativity and probably our ethnic diversity as well. You get different cures in different parts of the country. My favorite, my wife's grandmother had a recipe box, and she had all of her beloved recipes for muffins and cakes and pies. She was a wonderful baker, but tucked in there was her recipe for the common cold. And if I'm remembering this right, it was a tablespoon of lemon juice, a tablespoon of honey, and a pretty good dose of whiskey.
For morale purposes, no doubt.
And so I think, you know, in terms of symptom relief, it's a little different tack there, but I guess if you had enough of that, you wouldn't care if you had a cold.
Well, if we look at some of the home remedies, I'll call them, I mean, what validity do they have? I mean, if you look at, for example, chicken soup or even chicken broth, is the steam from that broth doing you as much good as the broth itself? Or what, is there value in it, or is it all psychological?
That's a good question. The common cold is a little bit sensitive to heat. It likes to grow in the airways because they're a little bit cooler than the rest of your body. And so people have tried steam, which, you know, is very, you know, it's pretty warm, as a way to try and slow down common cold replication and reduce symptoms. And it really didn't work very well. So it's been tried a couple of times. I think that using saline in the nose, you know, there's these saline nasal sprays or various devices for putting saline in, has been shown to have some validity. It will wash out any secretions in the nose that are kind of blocking airflow and help relieve some of the congestion that people have. So that's one thing that we recommend, and especially if you or your child is prone to getting sinus infections afterwards, you know, keeping those passages open and clear is probably a good idea. We actually were involved in some experiments. The other thing that the common cold doesn't like is acid, low pH, and which is one reason that these viruses don't grow in the stomach. They
Sounds
grow
like
in the,
your
in the lungs.
Grandmother's lemon juice to me.
Yeah, yeah.
Or Linus Pauling's vitamin C.
That's right. And actually, if you take common cold viruses, at least rhinoviruses, the major ones that cause the cold, and put in a little lemon juice in a beaker with viruses, they'll be dead in 5 seconds. So it really does kill them. The problem is, of course, that the common cold viruses that you really want to kill are not the ones in the beaker. They're the ones that are in your epithelial cells, and it's hard to acidify your airway. Actually, we tried that. We had a grant from Procter & Gamble about, this is going back almost 10 years, and we showed that certain types of acidic solutions were more likely than others to inactivate the viruses extremely quickly. And you can actually take low-strength acid solutions, ones that have a pH that's a little bit below normal but not markedly so, and they're very well tolerated when you spray them in the nose. So we did a study where we followed a bunch of people who had colds, either with just plain old saline nasal spray or these slightly acidic sprays. And we did see less virus, you know, coming out of the nose, but really no change in cold symptoms. And I think the problem was we really couldn't get that common cold remedy to where it really counted the most,
which was the lungs.
In the lungs and in the cells where the virus was replicating.
Honey, so. Any validity to that at all? I mean, it does make you feel nicer, I guess.
Yeah. Honey is something that's tasty, and I think it's...
kind of a reward for suffering.
Yeah.
There was a recent story in the New York Times. Well, the headline is The Claim, Drink Plenty of Fluids to Beat a Cold. But then the argument is apparently that drinking lots of fluids is not shown to actually do anything to help with the cold, even though we've all been told that.
Right. With any form of illness, you don't want to get dehydrated because you'll just feel worse than you felt initially. So I think there's some validity in not drying out. But overdoing it with fluids means more trips to the bathroom and little else, I think. Right.
What about the business of fighting cold? I mean, if you go to any drugstore, there's a big chunk of that store that's devoted to preventing the cold, treating the symptoms.
Right.
You know, how much of that is just money-making?
Well, that reminds me of a story about zinc. The first articles, I think, that came out showing that zinc had some benefit on colds spurred a tremendous increase in sales of these zinc remedies. And I think that one of the early articles, one of the authors of that article had bought stock in zinc before this article was published. Subsequent articles have not shown much of an effect at all, and zinc can cause some stomach upset. And I think the most recent thing was zinc put in the nose can dampen your sense of smell, and some people had lasting loss of their sense of smell. So there's huge economic gain if you can, you know, come up with a study that shows any benefit at all of a common cold remedy. So these things are really scrutinized very carefully now. And you know, we all know that when you read one study that comes out that says something startling, you need to back that up with other, you know, studies from different groups that show the same thing. One of the reasons that there are so many things in the drugstore that we can buy to help relieve cold symptoms is because none of them work all that well. I mean, if one of them worked, you'd probably buy that and stick with it, and so would everybody else. But there's, I think, 200 in some stores, different cough and cold and, you know, homeopathic remedies for common colds. So, you know, nothing works all that well.
Well, you mentioned the lungs and the cold virus. Some of the cold viruses will actually go down and attach themselves to the walls of the lungs.
Right.
So is an expectorant desirable for that at all? Is it effective?
You know, it seems like a good idea to get secretions out of the chest, but it turns out that the expectorants don't do very much for common colds. They're just not that good at what they do, and so it's not that helpful. Studies have shown that about half of colds, you know, do affect the chest, and this is especially true in young children and the elderly. Some of these epidemics that we see of bronchitis in nursing homes and in daycare centers can be caused by these common cold viruses.
You're not giving us a lot of hope here, Jim.
Well, you know, I think there are some things that people can do to really foster just good health in general. And some new ideas about things that might be effective at preventing colds. So in general, you know, this is going to sound like old hat, but people who get more exercise, there's some, you know, evidence that exercise, if you're fit, you're less likely to get common colds. And there's some research here at UW now. Dr. Bruce Barrett is testing that hypothesis again. And I think a diet that is a healthy diet where you're getting the types of fresh fruits and vegetables and so forth is going to promote good health and a healthy immune system. There's a lot of interest now in vitamin D. You know, it's something you think about Wisconsin in the wintertime, especially on a day like this. You know, we get a lot of our vitamin D from sunlight, right. And there's not a lot of sun exposure here for about 5 months out of the year. And some evidence now that kids who are deficient in vitamin D are more likely to develop an array of different respiratory disorders, including influenza and asthma, and even some evidence with common colds. So
more so than kids in Arizona or Florida?
Those are studies that need to be done. There was recently a big asthma study that looked at common cold-induced asthma, and they did find a north-south gradient. So Madison was the northernmost city participating in the study and was the city where you were most likely to find virus-induced asthma attacks.
And with less vitamin D getting from the sun.
Possibly. You know, it's still a theory, but it's one that can be tested.
Are there differences in population in general between you know, men and women, between different ethnic groups, in terms of who gets the most cold?
Yeah, we don't know as much about the effects of ethnicity, but we do know that early on, little boys are more likely to get symptomatic colds than little girls and are more likely to have the more severe wheezing illnesses that affect the chest than little girls.
Okay, and can you give us a take on that? And has this persisted? I mean, when you said that, I thought right away, oh, they're playing outside, grubbing around more, but I'm not sure that's been true for the last 30 or 40 years.
Probably not. I think that there's definite evidence that there are differences in the way boys and girls develop in the first 6 or 7 years of life, the way their immune systems develop. Boys are more susceptible to allergies and asthma, for example, early on. And there seems like there ought to be a hormonal clue there, and people are looking for it very carefully. But so far, the observations are there, but we don't really know why.
So what is the connection between colds and asthma then?
Well, asthma is probably one of the most important risk factors for developing more severe colds. And it seems to be, especially in kids, it's the kids who have allergic asthma who really tend to get these bad exacerbations of asthma when they get a cold. So there's something about the way that the body handles a common cold infection and the way the body handles allergies where, you know, there are some connections there. And one of the focuses in my laboratory is to try and figure out why allergies are such an important factor in who develops asthma and who develops these more severe, you know, viral infections.
What about the hygiene hypothesis that we hear about where somehow it seems as if children who are exposed to more pet dander and dirt and everything are actually in some ways healthier? Is that true?
Yeah, there's some dramatic demonstrations of that. I just finished a 6-month sabbatical. Emily, you and I were talking about this. And one of the things that I was able to do was to visit a group in Munich, Germany. There's a researcher there, Dr. von Mudius, who's been studying differences in health among children who grow up on traditional dairy farms and children who grow up in rural areas but don't have that farm animal exposure. And she's shown very clearly that kids who have early life exposure to barns. So what is it about the barns? It could be the hay, it could be the animals, it could be foods that they eat, you know, the raw milk, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something about that early contact with barns that reduces your rate of asthma almost by half and has probably even greater effects on who develops allergies and who doesn't. And what I was very interested about is in central Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin, of course, we have a big dairy industry. And some of the same observations appear to be true in Wisconsin. So we're proposing a study in collaboration with the Marshfield Clinic where we'll try and look at that in greater detail. We suspect that growing up on a farm has beneficial effects not just for allergies and asthma, but also for respiratory health in general, and that these kids may be less likely to develop these respiratory viral illnesses and influenza and virus-induced asthma. We're hoping that this funding comes through. We'd love to study this. It seems like a wonderful thing if we can figure out how to prevent these diseases rather than how to treat them. I think that would be a major advance.
So it's specifically, so far as we know, living on farms that helps to prevent asthma rather than living with animals. In other words, you can't say, well, I'll get my kid a couple more gerbils and, you know, maybe a dog and we'll all sleep in the same bed.
Probably not gerbils, but we have a study in Madison where it's called the COAST or Childhood Origins of Asthma Study. And we've studied a group of about 300 families who actually joined the study when the moms were pregnant. So it was prenatal enrollment. So we got to meet the children really early on. And what we found is that kids in Madison who grow up with dogs in their home, again, seem to have some health benefit. And it seemed to be important that that dog be in the home early on in the first couple of years. But the kids did seem to be less likely to develop allergic skin disease, atopic dermatitis, and also less likely to develop asthma out to about age 6. So after that, the effect seems to fade out a little bit.
So the obvious theory from an amateur would be that they're developing this immunity to various allergies by minimal exposure early on, like any other kind of inoculation.
Right, right. There's a lot of interest in what's called the microbiota. You know, we always think about bacteria and fungi as being germs, you know, things that are you're gonna catch a bacteria, catch a virus, catch a bacteria, and it's gonna make you ill. But it's very clear that the great majority of organisms in our environment don't cause disease. They're not pathogens. And so, in fact, they're not just innocent bystanders. They may actually be important for us to develop normal immunity. So there's a lot of energy right now with new diagnostic methods that are available here at University of Wisconsin and many other places to try and see, you know, what kind of microenvironment are we living in? And it's very clear that there are scores of bacteria on our skin and in our intestinal tract and even in our respiratory tract that aren't causing us any harm. And there is more and more evidence that certain types of bacteria and even fungi may be necessary for you to develop your best immunity. And so I think it's a pretty exciting time. I think there's some new concepts out there. If you like nature, you know, this is kind of, it seems to be a call, you know, get closer to nature and you're going to be healthier. So, well, we'll see. There's some big ideas out there, some of which are going to probably prove to be wrong. But, you know, we hope that some of them are right and it leads to some new insights that'll help us prevent these diseases.
Well, I'm expecting some kind of rebirth of the pet industry then, you know.
Yeah.
It looks like there could be some room for considerable progress there somehow.
Right. Well, maybe what we need are neighborhood petting zoos. So
yeah,
you
that's
can get
right.
up close and personal with a cow or a
lamb.
Haven't
there been some studies of people who actually work at pet stores in terms of allergies too?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you have kind of almost overexposure,
yep,
what happens?
Oh, well, it's pretty clear if you do develop an allergy to a pet, you know, because we think about dogs in the home. I just mentioned that early in life they may be beneficial. But if you're one of those children who develops a dog allergy and then you live with a dog in your home, you know, it's going to cause problems. These kids can have problems with their, you know, their noses or their lungs or their skin.
Probably even more true of cats.
It's true of cats as well. That's right. So we love our pets, but sometimes they can cause some problems. So by and large, we think that that early exposure makes it less likely to develop allergy. But if you're one of those who does develop an allergy, then, you know, it's best to minimize your contact.
Always gets complicated. We'll look further at the common cold and its ramifications when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest James Gern, who is filling us in about the current state of the battle against the common cold, which, of course, turns out to be much more complicated than just a common cold. There are some 200 or more varieties of what are lumped under the category of a common cold. And people who are at high risk are more likely, of course, to get the cold, but also to have more severe symptoms as a result of it. So how early on can we actually determine if somebody's going to be high risk?
There are a couple of things that you can look for. And the first is signs of allergies and asthma. So children who are born and start to develop more severe coughing and wheezing when they get colds are at increased risk for asthma. And if you continue to follow these children, they tend to be the same ones who develop allergies. The first type of allergies that often develop are food allergies, and those same children seem to be at increased risk for developing, you know, allergies to things like dust mite and cat and dog and later pollens on down the line. And so when you start to build that sort of a profile, you know, wheezing with viruses, starting to get allergies, those are kids who are really prone to developing asthma and more severe manifestations when they get a cold.
So asthma is something that you're born with, or is it something you have an inclination to get that can be exacerbated by these other conditions we've
talked about? Yeah, I think it's the latter. There's a lot of heredity toward who gets asthma and who doesn't. So if your mother has asthma, you have about a 25% risk. If your mother and father both have it, it's more like a 50% risk. But not everybody gets it. And so the environment seems to be quite important. And as we learn more about how these early life exposures change your risk of asthma, you know, that may give us some ammunition to be able to design preventive strategies down the line.
What about people who have an early instance of some other kind of lung problem like cystic fibrosis? How does getting a cold affect them?
Yeah, there's a couple of factors to think about there. Number one, if you have cystic fibrosis or chronic obstructive lung disease, you don't have a lot of reserve. And so an illness that may be minor in some people, might be enough to kind of push you over the edge and really, flare your chronic disease. So that's one possibility. And the other possibility is that there may be some conditions in the airways when you have these chronic lung diseases that for some reason seem to invite these common cold infections to occur and maybe promote viral replication. So I think it's those two things. Number one, your lungs aren't that stable. And number two, it could be that underlying disease somehow enhances your susceptibility to these cold viruses.
It sounds as if, from what we've said so far, that the real key to avoiding, let's say, a common cold is prevention rather than cure. I mean, we really still don't have a cure for what we're calling the common cold.
That's right. A cure is still in the future, and we touched at the beginning of the program on why it's been such a difficult thing. We put a man on the moon, but we haven't been able to cure the common cold.
That's kind of a joke they have in one of the Star Trek episodes, by the way. Refer to that.
Is it really?
We've done this, we've gone to this galaxy, but we still don't have a cure for the common cold.
Yeah. And part of that is the fact that there's so many viruses that can cause a cold, and to make a big dent, you've got to cure most of those viruses. And so to find one agent that has that sort of talent is pretty tough. But there are some new approaches coming on as we learn more about the types of immune responses that are important for having an effective response to the cold. To me, the most amazing thing when you look at kids in daycare centers is not that some of the kids are coming home with, coughs and sneezes and whatnot. It's that there's some kids in the daycare center who aren't getting sick. We know they're getting infected, but they're not getting sick. And so these kids seem to have a more effective immune response to the virus somehow. And if we can figure out what that is and then learn how to promote that in other children, that would be wonderful. I think that's where this farm research is so important as well. Obviously, there's a pretty small percentage of our population who live on dairy farms. It's such an important, segment of the population in Wisconsin. But still, most people live in cities and really don't have contact with these animals. But if we could figure out what it is about, that farm lifestyle that really promotes health and seems to reduce your risk of having more severe respiratory disease, we might be able to bring that to people who live under other circumstances.
Well, if we were going to summarize what we've heard so far in terms of preventing the common cold, you would have, of course, the exposure to those farm animals, so far as we can tell.
Mm-hmm.
But also another aspect, I believe, of farm life, even in a highly mechanized farm life, is it's a more active, it's more physically active. And you say that's one of the ways of fending off a common cold, is just to be physically more fit.
I think physical fitness is important. The farm connection is still pretty much a theory right now, but it's one that I'm, at least I'm very interested in.
Sunshine.
We mentioned sunshine and vitamin D, and that could play a role. So that's something that I think bears looking into.
There's one you can't do much about. That's genetics, I assume.
Yeah, you can't do a lot about the genetics at this point. One other category that we didn't touch on, and that's that people who are exposed to pollutants certainly are more likely to get colds and more likely to get severe colds. There's some good epidemiologic studies that show that. So personal use or passive tobacco smoking really promotes more severe colds. And things like ozone and nitric oxide is another indoor air pollutant that can promote colds. And probably the way those things work is they just tend to harm that epithelial layer, that lining of your lungs and your nose and whatnot that's so important in keeping us healthy. And so if that's damaged, it's kind of a chink in the armor. It kind of serves the same purpose that our skin does. And, of course, we all know if you skin your knee, it's much more likely to become infected than if you have an intact layer of skin there.
So if you're on a warm tropical island without too many people and not much pollution.
Not too many small kids.
If you look at sort of worldwide, just to sort of, are there pockets of the globe where people really don't get very many colds?
It's a great question, and it's one I'd love to study.
Yeah.
Maybe next week.
Get a sabbatical to travel around.
That's right. But, the problem has been that for common cold research, diagnostic tests Yeah, I mean, we all know that when you go to the doctor and you have symptoms and they seem to be a cold, you're told that it's a virus. But there really hasn't been ways that we can do that and prove that on a large scale until just recently. So the last 10 years or so, there have been some really good tests that can detect these viruses. And I think with those sorts of tools, we can do those sorts of studies and see whether the prevalence of colds is really better in Trinidad than it is here. We actually had a postdoctoral student from Trinidad who came up, and it's pretty clear that the seasonality of colds is much different there. They're very close to the equator. And instead of having a spring and fall predominance of colds, which is what we usually see, it had to do with their rainy season and wet season. But the prevalence of colds didn't change all that much throughout the year, which was a little bit surprising. So we've got a lot to learn from going to other climates and so forth and using these new tools to see how cold patterns are different there than they are in Wisconsin.
I was going to speculate, and this would be the less desirable research than going to, you know, Trinidad, but I was going to speculate that older people, by and large, would be less susceptible to colds because they wouldn't have the young children bringing those viruses into the home so much as parents of young children would.
I think that's the case. Yeah.
If you do have someone who already has a serious illness like cystic fibrosis or asthma or something else, and they get a cold, what can be done to sort of keep it from becoming, you know, very serious or even life-threatening situation?
Yeah, that's an important question. And I think that the two things that we think about are, A, you know, what are the best preventive things that you can do to keep your disease under control? Because kids who have cystic fibrosis, let's say, and have well-controlled disease are less likely to have one of those flares than kids with cystic fibrosis who have, you know, disease that's really unstable. So the first thing is, what can you do to control your underlying disease? And so there needs to be a treatment plan that's in place that addresses that. And then the second thing is, most chronic diseases have what are called step-up plans. These are really common in asthma and in COPD, and I would imagine in cystic fibrosis as well. So you have this regimen that you use to keep your disease under control on a daily basis. Well, what if you start to feel like you have a cold? And that's where, you know, it's different for different diseases, but generally you intensify, you know, your treatment regimen and try and stay ahead of that cold so that you can catch it in the early stages rather than let things go on and really become more of a serious problem. So I think those step-up plans and have that written and have that be in good communication with your healthcare provider so that you know just what to do when you get the first signs of a cold. We know that there's nothing we can give right now that kills the cold virus effectively. That's still a ways in the future. For influenza, there are some things, but not for common cold viruses. So it's really maximizing the baseline treatment of your underlying disease that seems to be important.
So is there going to be a breakthrough anytime soon in curing the common cold? And if so, what would it be, or what would you like it to be?
Yeah, I think that the biotech industry has a couple of good candidates for common cold medications that will cover rhinoviruses, which are the most common viruses that cause the cold, probably account for about half of colds year-round, but the majority of ones in the spring and in the fall. So that's, you know, I think there are some improved things that are in clinical trials right now. But I'm also really intrigued by companies and universities that are studying these immune response mechanisms that we all have but are better in some people than others. So there are a couple of companies now that are trying to use that information to either improve your own antiviral responses, maybe on a seasonal basis. You know, what could I take? My child's going back to school. What can I do to kind of ramp up my antiviral responses for the next month or two? Or they're identifying places in the body that the virus uses, you know, to gain a foothold. And they're trying to...
Your air passages.
Exactly. So trying to keep that epithelium in good shape and maybe making it more slippery so the virus cannot, you know, attach. And this might be something that might be effective against a whole host of viruses instead of just one at a time. So lots of new ideas. I think in the past 5 years or so, there's been an increase in activity that is kind of targeted at the common cold, and not much activity, you know, for about the 10 years before then. So
And with a personal question, what do you personally do? You know, you're around a lot of people with colds and so on. I mean, what do you personally do that you think, you know, what might help you not get colds, and once you get it, to get rid of it fast?
Right. Well, I'm really careful to wash hands in and out of every exam room I go into. I'm a firm believer.
That sounds really good.
And that, and of course, it's something that's stressed hospital-wide for a variety of reasons right now. But I think that's really important in that. And personally, and I think it is important to, you know, look at overall good health, though. So I try and, you know, get some exercise. I try and eat right and that sort of thing. And personally, I think there's enough validity in the vitamin D hypothesis. So I take a little vitamin D in the wintertime. I don't need much in the summer because I love to be outdoors and so forth. But I do think that that's a hypothesis that might bear some fruit. And there are other benefits as well to having enough vitamin D. Now, people argue over how much you should take per day. The USDA recently increased what they say is the daily requirement for vitamin D. You know, they used to think it was, I think, 200 units a day, and now they've gone up to 400 units a day, and it varies with the age group and whatnot. But it seems like a plausible hypothesis. So.
You can get it in milk, too.
And you can get it in milk. That's right.
Our guest has been James Gurn, filling us in about the latest thinking about the common cold, how to prevent it, and what to do about it if you do get one. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us in a healthy way for the next University of the Year. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 when our guest is David Mulroy, and he'll answer the question, did Oedipus have an Oedipus complex? And we'll look even more closely at Sophocles and his great play next Sunday afternoon at 4 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.